History happened everywhere.
The verdict.
This is our after-show podcast where we look back at the most recent episode, episode 87, Hotspots in the Sun during the Space Age, which of course is 1957 to 1975. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and check it out, or else you will find spoilers ahead.
Oh, Sappho! 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 Sappho!
Hello, my name is Pete Goddard, and I'm here in the HAT studio with the ultraviolet rays to my sunscreen. It's Mr. Ryan Weir.
I am. I'm ultraviolet.
And I'm sunscreen, which blocks you out. And we are, of course, joined as ever by the dreamy decider of destinies. It's the judge himself, Mr. Paul Dursley.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening, Judge. Now, I've been basking in the glorious rays of the spring sunshine all week, and consequently I've forgotten everything about the last episode. So, Ryan, would you mind reminding me what we talked about in about 60 seconds?
Well, I mean, I can do that, but when do you want me to do it?
I'd like you to do it now.
In this week's blazing episode of Cosmic Brilliance, we invited you to the heart of the solar system to have a plasma party in the sun. From the roasting core to the fiery corona, we discovered all there is to know about solar hotspots like flares and loops and Cycle 19, which battered Earth's surface during the 1960s. Then we switched gears and cozied up with the controversial models who got Britain's tongues wagging and knickers in a twist with their controversial appearance in page 3 of Rupert Murdoch's newspaper, The Sun. But the real heat came from the Greek island of Mykonos, where we heard firsthand the sizzling rites of passage story of Nick the Greek's summer of sun worship on the island's blossoming vacation scene. We had solar hotspots, we had tabloid drama, we had a Grecian odyssey. It was Hotspots on the Sun during 1957 to 1975.
Last week's episode done, summarised nicely, nice one son. Now we're over to a young Dursley, who's gonna tell you what he thought of thee. He'll take you apart without any care, he's the lovely Paul Dursley, the lovely Paul Dursley.
Ah, yes, I remember it all now. What a glorious fireball in the sky of an episode it was. I particularly enjoyed the trip to Mykonos, and I'll admit, also talking about nudie ladies. But what does it matter what I think? It matters nothing. Nobody cares about my opinion. We're here for one opinion, and that's yours, Judge Dursley. So, Paul, before we reach the final verdict, why don't you tell us your first impressions of episode 87?
It started off okay and went downhill.
Did it go downhill after the physics stopped?
Yes.
Yes, I thought it perhaps might. But there was plenty of physics in there, Paul. I did my absolute best before my brain actually melted and poured out of my ears.
Okay, shall we get this elephant in the room before we even start?
Oh, dear.
I want to know your workings about the number of Frances covering the sun.
Always a difficult one when you're in space.
He's obsessed about us getting this wrong.
Which we do frequently.
And what ridiculous number did you give?
11 trillion or something.
Yeah.
Was that wrong?
Yes, considerably wrong.
Right. Maths is not our strong point, Paul. Can you please correct me?
It's not really maths, it's just arithmetic.
And right. That's different because...
Well, is it even simpler?
Oh.
Well, you know, we even had a given. You know how many Frances covered the Earth from last episode.
Yeah, I tried. I tried.
Which we agreed was 800.
Right.
Didn't we? So it's an incredibly simple calculation, isn't it, to work out the surface area of the Earth compared to the surface area of the sun.
Oh, I know.
When you know the radius of each.
Crazy simple. Just tell them, Paul. Tell them.
Well, the actual answer is surprisingly small.
It can't be.
It is 9.5 million, that's all.
That cannot be right.
Okay, the radius of the Earth is 4,000 miles.
Feel free to skip forward 30 seconds, listeners.
The radius of the Sun is 400,000. So the ratio between those two is 1 to 100.
I knew him, the ratio.
So that's the linear ratio to get the ratio for an area. An area is a length squared, so you square it. So the surface area of the Sun is 10,000 times the surface area of the Earth.
And that means 10,800 Francis, which is 8 billion trillion Francis.
So on that rough calculation, it comes out at 8 million Francis. But, you know, if you put the real, more accurate numbers in, you get 9.5.
Well, I have to say, I thought you were onto a good thing, Ryan, with the application of physics to your episode. I thought that was a guaranteed way to get a solid grade in a Dursley judgment.
Well, yeah. I mean, I tried. Was there enough sun-based stuff in there for you, Paul?
There could have been a lot more.
I'll be honest, I did give up a little bit with that stuff because it all got a little bit complicated.
I was surprised by the plasma, actually. I had not realised that plasma was a state of matter in the same way as solid, liquid and gas were.
Yes.
Nor did I.
Well, it's a sort of ionised gaseous state. But it's not really gaseous.
Right. So what I did was go, what is an ionised state? And then I got confused because it was all like smashing ions and stuff into each other. And I even went online to like the Sun for Idiots. Still didn't understand it.
But what's the most simple example of plasma? A flame.
What?
Wait, a flame is a plasma?
Yes. That's an example of the plasma.
Well, I've learned something new.
That's why we have this podcast. Now, Paul, I thought I'd better bring some physics to the table as well. And I had a thought, a wonder, if you will, which was we have the Sun, right, which is the star in our star system. And I wondered if every star system in the galaxy, the universe, is there always a sun/star in all of them?
Well, the answer probably is yes, at some time, but not necessarily now, because there are wandering planets that do not have a star associated with them, and not all stars would have planets around them.
Exactly. The wandering planet is what I discovered.
Which is a tautology, by the way, wandering planet.
Oh.
Well, because a wandering planet is actually a planet because it comes from the word for wanderer, as they wandered across the sky.
We're all wandering across the sky. But yeah, most planets sort of rotate around a star, much like us and the Sun. These are planets that apparently somehow get flung off from or in other ways divorced from their stars. And there's just these planets that are just floating, I guess, through space with no sun to keep them warm. In 2013, astronomers found one 88 light years from Earth. This is a planet that's 6 times bigger than Jupiter, just floating around on its own in space.
Planet Hobo.
So that size, it's almost a star. It's a failed star, basically, if it's that size.
Well, funnily enough, they said they've called it an orphaned planet. Planet, because previously they weren't sure if they were failed stars or orphaned planets. This one was called... Brian, you mentioned the name. Do you want to have another guess at what they called this planet?
Planet Vagrant.
Incorrect. It is PSOJ318.5-22.
Yeah, I wasn't going to get that.
you'd have got there eventually.
But apparently this is exciting news for astronomers because, A, it confirmed that these rogue planets actually exist and they've seen one. But there's a bonus because apparently when you try and study planets, the bright sun that it is near them, relatively speaking, in the universe, obscures what you can see. So they can actually see this planet without the distracting illumination of a nearby sun to bother them. So they're hoping to find things out by studying PSOJ318.5-22.
Wow, that's amazing. Until it wanders into your solar system asking for a couple of coins to get a walk drive home.
All it wants, yeah, just want a cup of tea and a sun of my own.
But we will all turn our back on it.
Just pretend we didn't see it.
Right, I want to talk solar power.
Please do.
Because as I was doing my research, there was more stuff physics-y that I was looking at. But the chance to talk about horny teenage boys and topless models.
The chance to talk about titties just titillated you.
It was a strong magnetism that I felt. But there was some other information that I had. It wasn't quite as strong, so I did end up cutting it. But I thought I'd bring it here because I still thought it was quite interesting. So as we know, the solar power industry has become something of a major player in the energy scene. Global climate change and such, people are looking for ways in which you can get free and abundant resources of energy. And so the sun is obviously a key way of getting that. Technology has been developed like solar photovoltaic cells, which we will know as solar panels. Those are starting to become more and more popular as we're looking to move away from fossil fuels. And as that technology has progressed, the price of that technology has fallen. There's been about an 80% decrease in the price of solar cells over the past decade, and greater capacity too. So 10 years ago, it was 40 gigawatts, and now it's around about 600 gigawatts. So, you know, you can capture a lot more energy in the solar cells. So that's great, but that's what's happening now. I was looking to see, well, what were solar cells around during the space race? So I was pleased to discover that the first practical solar cell was invented in 1954, created by American scientists at Bell Laboratories. And at the time, their cells had an efficiency rate of just 6%. The real problem was the cost. It was really expensive to produce these solar panels. It cost around $286 per watt, which in 1956, which is around $3,000 per watt today. So not ideal. So the Bell silicon solar panels, as they were called, weren't really used for anything other than for commercial purposes. And so NASA grabbed hold of it and they used it to power satellites and their spacecraft. NASA then took the technology and tried to improve on it. And by the 1970s, they were producing cheaper, more efficient solar cells. And they were being used more and more, not just in space, though, but also on Earth. And one of the first things that received this new technology was, any ideas?
Toaster.
Not toaster.
Kettle.
Not kettle.
I can't imagine any other use for energy.
Calculators. So the Sharp Corporation in Japan, they started to produce the world's first solar calculator in 1976. It was nicknamed Sun Man. And it was officially known, though, as the Sharp EL8026. So I don't know, maybe a relative of your son there, Pete.
Yeah, could be.
Wandering planet.
Same people are naming these things.
Yeah. It cost around about $40 to buy then, which was quite expensive, you know, just for a calculator. But
think of the savings on tiny batteries.
Think of the savings, exactly. And instead of using disposable batteries, it used an array of monocrystal S225 silicon photovoltaic module solar cells. Now, these were top-of-the-line solar cells. They had a conversion efficiency of, get this, 10%. Yeah? But because Sharp designed the calculator to have the cells on the back of the case, it did mean that it had to keep being flipped over. So the instruction manual actually advised users to leave it placed upside down in strong sunlight for several hours. So hopefully you weren't in like a big mid-calculation when you needed to use it when it ran out. The first solar-powered analog wristwatch appeared in the same year, 1976. It was called the Citizen Crystron Solar Cell, and it used four tiny solar panels in the face watch itself, which converted light.
Oh, to be
light.
Actually put it on the correct side of the face.
Yes, yeah, not on the wrist side, yeah. And it converted light into electricity to power the quartz movement inside. Anyway, it was advertised as being capable of running for months on a full charge, even in total darkness. And it said that it didn't even need to be sunlight. You could just use your regular old light bulb in the house. That would charge it. But where have we gone to since then? There's one new company that's working on technology that's going to allow visible light to shine through glass panels while simultaneously collecting the invisible rays in sunlight and transforming that into electricity. Chemical engineers are researching a solar paint, which would see this nanoscale mixture of photovoltaic components being sprayed or just painted onto various surfaces. Thousands of homes in Abu Dhabi are soon going to be powered by 9 photovoltaic pyramids, which are being installed in the desert. And in Inverness, in Scotland, they're trialling a solar-powered trash can that uses the sun to power an internal compactor, which reduces the waste that's inside and increases the capacity to be able to hold up to 8 times the amount of trash a regular can can hold.
It doesn't reduce the waste inside, it compresses it, but
And there is solar-powered refrigerators too.
I'm trying to get my head around the sort of various energy exchanges involved in that transaction.
You're right. What's the use case for a solar-powered refrigerator? Well, I thought that too, so I looked into it, and it turns out that healthcare workers in developing countries can't rely on the electricity grid of these places to power the cold storage that's needed for vaccines and other medications that need to stay chilled. So a solar-powered refrigerator has been generated that will be able to do that for you. So it just constantly stays cool all the time, regardless of where you are in the world.
But it also keeps your wine cool for a picnic.
Yeah.
More importantly. Excuse me, Dursley, where's my big rack of life-saving vaccines? Look, 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 look.
Underneath the Chardonnay.
I had to make space for my Riesling.
End of fact. Right, Peter, I need to talk to you about topless models because...
Because. You don't need a because to talk about topless models. Carry on.
Because as I was talking to you about this subject matter, I felt you pulling back from the discussion, not engaging in the way that perhaps I was expecting.
Yes.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on reflection about that subject.
I was a man of mixed feelings because the sort of right on part of me would say, well, you know, equality and fairness and objectification. But I have distinct recollections of being a youth and being able to see boobs in the newspaper and not objecting at all, to be honest with you. So it was such a formative part of my youth that I felt it would be hypocritical of me to say, oh, no, that's terrible, whilst also acknowledging that it is a controversial subject.
Yeah, well, yeah, but just think. Talk about that, how innocent those times were compared to today with the pornography on demand that children can watch.
Absolutely. What is available to 13-year-old boys in the UK today is very different to what was available to 13-year-old boys in the UK, well, certainly when I was growing up.
Well, the legendary hedge pornography.
Yes, out in the woods. That was your only real way of getting it. Top shelf magazines and Page Three. That was really where you saw it.
But yes, I was completely fine, as I said. But actually, it wasn't just me, because you mentioned Mr. Larry Lamb.
I did indeed, the editor of the Sun newspaper.
Sir Larry Lamb.
Yeah, indeed, Sir Larry Lamb, you're right. Now, I looked into him a little bit because he sounded like an interesting character. So
he also sounds like a cartoon character.
Well,
like some kids.
He was actually character. He named himself after a kids' TV character, actually. That's exactly correct.
Oh, no way. Okay.
He was born Albert Lamb in Yorkshire mining village.
Okay.
And he felt like he'd been given the wrong name, so he called himself Larry after a character in a TV show called Toy Town. This is a kind of wooden string puppet of a lamb.
Okay, I would have gone with roast.
So this is a guy who had a very strong sense of himself, as you can see, even down to his very name. So I took most of this from a single obituary, which was this obituary basically makes him sound like a very interesting man. By interesting, I mean quite horrible. It said, proving people wrong was at his core. He was overbearing, overcritical, and often over the top.
Well, who does that sound like?
What's wrong with that?
The writer of the obituary then says, he gave me a chance as a sub and I, sub editor, he gave me a chance as a sub and I suffered from his brutal teaching methods. All my colleagues were struck by his half-suppressed anger.
Wow. Yes, you can only imagine that Rupert Murdoch would only hire the best.
Well, this ironically actually spelled his doom because he was so convinced of his own rectitude that even though he was very successful at The Sun, but he didn't get given the editorship of The Times by Rupert Murdoch and circulation began to slide. And basically, Larry got a bit above himself and Murdoch went, nah, you're going to have to go. He gave Lamb a second chance after a couple of years and made him the editor-in-chief of The Australian, but he just couldn't keep it up. He was there for 9 months. And one of the execs said, Larry just couldn't help himself. He had megalomaniac tendencies and kept clashing with Rupert. Imagine arguing with Rupert Murdoch.
Didn't he have a nickname in Australia? But I can't think of what it was.
I can't imagine it was very flattering, but...
I'll have the...
Oh, God. So he writes a book at the sunset of his life, ironically called Sunrise. This was in 1989. And actually in that, he says that he thinks that the introduction to page 3 might have been a mistake.
Right. Oh, okay. That's actually prescient then, because it closed long after that.
Yeah. So the final thing I'm going to leave you with from this obituary was, it says, ironically, it, meaning introducing page 3, might be his chief claim to fame, apart from a grateful line or two in Mrs. Thatcher's eventual memoirs.
Oh, wow.
That's brutal.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it was a bold decision, wasn't it? Showing nudity in the newspaper when Rupert Murdoch was away, when he was out of the country. I thought that was a nice little addition to that story, which I didn't know.
That was an interesting one, because you kind of want to say, it shows great faith in himself, because you can only assume the reason he did that was because he knew the results would mean that Rupert would come back and go, oh, why did you do that? And he can go, ta-da, it worked, rather than trying to convince him beforehand.
Well, yeah, you never ask somebody something if the answer is going to be no. You just do it.
Yeah, and he certainly sounded like a man who didn't tend to ask people what they thought, was in fact quite strident in his views, shall we say.
The other thing I picked up was about Rupert Murdoch being so stridently supportive of page 3, yet not publishing it in his Australian version of the newspaper because his mother was in the country and he didn't want to offend her.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how apocryphal that is, but certainly his mother lived in Australia and he didn't publish any topless images in Australia. So I guess maybe there is some truth to that rumour.
Yes, it's easy to be moral at home and then less so for bags of money elsewhere in the world, isn't it? And he'd had bags of money and still does. Go, Rupert. Side note, Rupert, if you'd like to sponsor any podcasts, both Ryan and I are prepared to go topless if necessary.
Oh, my God.
I'd prepare to go bottomless.
We're going all the way for you, Rupert.
I won't show you the sun. I'll show you the moon.
Hey,
I am not part of this deal.
That's okay. I think everyone agrees that's fine.
So, Ryan, I do have to thank you for finding a real-life human person who had been and had an interesting story to tell about Mykonos. How did you come about this fascinating character? Nick the Greek.
Nick the Greek, the famous, the infamous Nick the Greek.
This is to be borne in mind. He was known as Nick the Greek on a Greek island, which presumably featured other Greeks as well. So he must have been spectacularly Greek.
I mean, he was an 18-year-old dancing the Zorba in front of a bunch of tourists for 11 months. I mean, yeah, he got well known, I'm sure. But this all came about because I was looking for hot spots in the sun, and of course a tourist destination, an area that you might go to catch the sun seemed relevant, and there were plenty of places to look at, Santorini and Benidorm and many other places that popped up around this time. But the one that really stood out to me was Mykonos, and that was because it was such a small, tiny, traditional place for thousands of years, you know, isolated away from the mainland, and then suddenly, within a decade, their whole way of life has completely changed. It just seemed like there was a real human story to be told there, and so I sought out some support to help give us his insights into what that was like during the time, and boy did he deliver.
Big time.
You've been a sly one. I never knew you could speak Greek.
Yeah, I did get some help in terms of translation, I'll be honest.
only with the words, though.
Yeah, just the words.
Okay.
So I actually was thinking about gay tourism in Greek islands, Ryan, and I thought the obvious candidate for a likely gay tourist island in Greece was the island of Lesbos, which obviously was the origin of the word for lesbianism. And I wondered if lesbians consequently went on holiday to Lesbos. And indeed they do, it turns out. Apparently there's one village in the town which has 1,500 full-time residents and 3 lesbian bars.
No. Surely all the bars in Lesbos are lesbian bars.
Well, yes, you could definitely argue that.
All the men in Lesbos are lesbians.
Well, now I'm confused.
I was also looking at other places that might have been historic gay holiday destinations. So apparently there's a place called Fire Island in New York, just outside New York City, I guess, a couple of hours outside, which has been a long time gay travel destination. Oscar Wilde visited in 1882. It was popular in the 30s for the artistic and theatre types, make of that what you will. But also, according to Wikipedia, Philadelphia was the first destination in the world to create and air a television commercial specifically for gay tourists.
Wow, Philadelphia.
I know, I thought that as well.
I mean, would that have been a consequence of the film Philadelphia?
I don't think so. I think possibly the other way around. The community.
Well, but don't forget Philadelphia, city of brotherly love.
Huh.
Well, that's what Philadelphia means. Philadelphia.
Oh, I see. Philadelphia.
Yeah, because I just thought it was a guy called Phil who was from Delphia who set the place up. Oh, Philadelphia. Yeah, I know him.
And why are lesbians called after Lesbos?
It's after the poet Sappho, Ryan, a poet who is believed to have lived on the island of Lesbos. And she wrote, I think erotic poetry, I can't be 100% sure, but love poetry between two women. And she became kind of the archetypal, original gay female icon figure. And consequently, the island on which she lived gave a name to people who like people of the same sex and are women.
Okay. This is ancient Greek, I'm guessing.
Yes, I believe it's well old.
Yeah, it's a lot of that sort of goes for the Greeks, wasn't it? Because it was of the Greek persuasion was also a term for men.
Indeed. Greek love is another euphemism you may come across from time to time.
Well, that obviously comes from Sparta, where it was mandatory.
Well, look, either way, I was fascinated by the fact that 65% of the tourist community was gay. I thought that was remarkable.
Well, that was it. You can only imagine how freeing and liberating it must have been to be in a place where actually, because A, you're a majority, so suddenly you've gone from concealing yourself, I think I said, there was the phrase I used before, to being open and behaving literally normal, as in the majority of the people who are similar to you, and everyone else there who appreciates your custom and your presence rather than hounding you out of the place. Must have been an incredible feeling of liberation above and beyond holiday.
It's interesting though, isn't it, as well? It's the as soon as you get money involved, all opinions go out the window.
Yes, well, yeah. See Rupert Murdoch for details.
So in the episode, we heard from Nick the Greek, but there was another story based in Mykonos at around the same time, well, just a little bit earlier, so 1958. So yes, there's this local fisherman, he's out fishing, doing his thing, and he finds a wounded pelican. So he collects it and he brings it back to town with him, and with support from the rest of the Mykonian locals, they nurse it back to health, and they give it the name Petros. He hangs around and they look after him and take care of him. He lives there happily for years. He just sort of roams the streets and hangs out with the tourists, and there's even an anecdote about him causing a lawsuit where at one point Petro flew off of Mykonos and landed on the nearby island of Tinos, and the locals decided to keep him. And so the Mykonians took Tinos to court and won, after which Petro came back to Mykonos and there was a huge festival to welcome him back.
I can't believe this pelican's more popular than I am. Yes.
Supposedly, even the Orthodox and Catholic priests joined in. They rang all the bells of the churches in town.
We can make more money!
But unfortunately, in December 1985, Petros was hit and killed by a car.
Oh, these modern newfangled business.
How old was it if it was found in 57?
Over 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, although there are rumours that the car is a cover for a more unsavoury death at the hands of a horny tourist, but we won't elaborate any more on that.
I'm just stunned into silence, to be honest with you.
I'll let your minds wander on that one. But that wasn't the end of pelicans on Mykonos, or indeed of Petros himself, because in the outpouring of grief from the locals and visitors,
he was stuffed.
The island received a gift from Jackie Kennedy Onassis in the form of a new pelican called Irene. But they also received another pelican from Hamburg Zoo called Petro 2.
Petro 2.
So they had two pelicans now on the island, one of which was called Petro 2. And get this, a few years later, 1995 this is, another fisherman found another injured pelican. He brought it home, healed it, and called it
Petro 3.
No, Nicholas. And so that stays on the island as well. And so today, almost 40 years after Petro's death, you can still find Petro on Mykonos. And if you can't afford to visit Mykonos, which is fully understandable because it's full of the rich and wealthy at the moment, you can follow Petros the Pelican on Instagram at petros.mykonos. He has his own Instagram account.
Again, likely vastly more popular than ours. We've been outdone by a pelican. That was a downbeat ending. And so we have come to the end of the line. It's time to step into the dock, Ryan, and prepare to face the people's judge. Judge Dursley, are you ready to give your verdict?
Yes, I am.
Okay, will the defendant please rise?
I am rising.
Your Honour, as usual, can we start proceedings by first asking for your verdict on the factual content of the episode?
Well.
Oh, here we go.
What? You ask a question?
No, I was all right. Sorry. I just thought it was funny to say.
The factual content actually probably went up throughout the episode, given that you started off with something that I knew about so I could judge, and then you were going into other areas which I had less and less knowledge of. So in terms of factual content, I liked that you had a bit about the sun, and then you had a bit about the sun, then you had a bit about a place in the sun. So you are getting slightly more abstract at each turn. And for that reason, I shall give you B minus.
Ooh. All right. That is scorching.
And next up, Paul, if you could give us your verdict for entertainment value.
Well, the entertainment value was up and down, I think. There were some very amusing skits. There were some rather tedious bits. So, I'm afraid I can only give you C.
I'll take a C.
It's not terrible, actually. I think that's... we'll clutch that and move on. And Paul, finally, your verdict for Dursley Factor, the ineffable, the mysterious Factor Dursley.
So, I didn't see where it was going. I was expecting more of the sun as a physical object in the sky, but I think you actually did a very good job of turning it back towards the main focus of the podcast in terms of history, as history of the sun, but actually picking up a couple of things which were related to the sun, the newspaper, and sunspots, I thought was rather good. And for that reason, Ryan, you might be surprised to know, I will give you B plus.
Yes! B plus?
Good stuff. So that's it. We've come to the final verdict. But before the judge passes his ruling, Ryan, you have an opportunity to enter a plea if you choose to do so. Please make that plea now.
No, absolutely not. Not a chance. Not saying a thing.
Very wise.
Your Honour, thank you very much.
In that case, Your Honour.
Your generosity and your kindness.
Okay, not a plea, not a grovel. Your Honour, the defendant stands before you. Have you reached your verdict?
Yes, I have.
In that case, I respectfully ask for your ruling.
I'm going to play it straight on this, so I will average the scores and give you a straight B.
B! All right!
Nice!
That's so good.
Solid grade. It's all that science. I knew that science would give you a good grade.
I just find it so fascinating. You get a B and you're excited.
I mean, it's better than getting an ungraded episode, isn't it? Imagine getting that.
Well, I don't know. It's kind of special to do something unusual, isn't it?
Is it, though?
Is it?
Is it getting the worst grade ever?
In a way, it's the best ever.
I don't know. Thanks, Judge.
My pleasure. Judge.
Okay, that's our show for this week. If you'd like to get in touch about any of the things we talked about on the show, or congratulate Ryan, or just say hello, you can reach out to us on social media through our website, hhepodcast.com, or email peteandryan@hhepodcast.com.
That's right, we would love to hear from you, and you never know, you might end up featured on a future show, like Spoil My Movie, who gave us, Pete, a very delicious and lovely five-star review on Good Pods.
What an excellent individual that is, full of great judgment and character. And see, all you have to do is rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and you'll feature on the show. And your recommendation, of course, helps us bring the show to new listeners.
That's right. Now, if you are on Mastodon, Facebook, Instagram, or X, you can find us at HHE Podcast. And if you subscribe to those, you're going to get an alert every time we post pictures of the solar eclipse and photos of topless models.
Unfortunately, it's of Ryan and Pete. Biggest tits on the internet.
And we'll be back again soon with our next episode, number 88, Nutrition in China in the Second Century.
I'm excited for that one.
But in the meantime, a huge thank you to the judge himself. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure.
And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is...
you've been listening to... Paul, have you ever been to a nudist beach?
No. I've been on a beach where some people took their clothes off.
That sounds a lot like a nudist beach.
Follows a lot of the criteria, if not all of them.
But I didn't.
Did you just sit there and watch?
Well, I think we got up and went.
I can only envisage Paul in one of those stripy Edwardian sort of long shorts with bathing outfits.
With a straw boater.
Exactly, emerging from a changing shed.
And what's wrong with that? Come off
well,
it.
Well, you don't want to get your monocle wet, and that's all I'm saying.
Well, you know, in my world, all melons are juicy.